Can you give us two examples of Ceausescu's gigantomania?
Among the most conspicuous outcomes of Mr. Ceausescu's interest in turning his rule into kind of unforgettable event in Romanian history, I would mention first, of course, the Black Sea or the Danube Black Sea Canal, which is an extraordinary waste of money, an extraordinary investment, absolutely reminding one of Stalin's dreams of creating or of turning the Soviet Union into a kind of empire of canals, everywhere canals, and also with forced labor and so on. And of course, the other thing is his decision to bulldozer almost half of the historical center of Bucharest, to destroy a lot of important historical monuments, cultural monuments, religious monuments for a country like Romania, where history has been so many times threatened by foreign invasions and so on. Religious monuments belong to they are the only proof of our survival there. And now this man, who claims to be the symbol of Romanian patriotism, is spearheading the campaign for the destruction of the most important historical monuments in Bucharest. Bucharest is not the same city I left behind in 81 when I left Romania. All the pictures I get from Bucharest, all the information I get from my friends there suggest to me that Bucharest is nowadays very much like Pyongyang, or very much, I suppose, like Mengistu's Addis Abeba or something like that, not like the very attractive city I used to know in the south of Romania.
To what extent is Romania an anachronism, a one-off, or are all communist states potential Romanias?
I think that to Mr. Ceausescu's credit, he cannot be regarded only like a Peribu of contemporary socialism, kind of Idi Amin Dada of East European socialism. Now, I think that he has experimented, sometimes even with Moscow's approval, one of the possible ways of developing socialism in this century. I don't think that the Romanian experiment is a betrayal of the socialist ideals and so on. I don't want to use such terms. I think this was a well-conceived, initially, a well-conceived experiment into the appropriation of nationalist symbols by a communist regime placed in a critical situation. So in this respect, I assume that other communist regimes in critical situations might rediscover the manipulative value of nationalism, of patriotic symbols that they can appropriate. They can fraudulently, of course, appropriate these symbols and create the same kind of frenzy, of nationalistic frenzy, entrancement and so on, like Ceausescu did. This was the beginning. Now, sometimes in history we all know that you cannot control all the effects. It started this way, now it's a bit out of control. So perhaps this thing would not happen the same way, let's say, the day Kadar's successor would discover the need to functionalize the Hungarian nationalist ideology, or let's say, Jaruzelski himself would rediscover the pleasures of mocharism. We all know that such a thing existed in Poland in 1968. Actually, the same socialist demagogy plus nationalism and so on was Mochar's line. There's no strong difference between, let's say, the jingoistic vocabulary of the Romanian right-left ideology, if you want, the Ceausescuism and the mocharism in 1968 as anti-foreign, anti-Western, obsessed with the national destiny, with the national predestination, and so on. So it's, I think it, and also it's very appealing. I'll give just one example. It's very appealing for third world radical elites. The only example I would give is the fact that Mengistu's constitution was written after a group of legal experts of the Revolutionary Party in Ethiopia went to Bucharest. And actually, it's almost copied Talek Vale from the Romanian constitution.
To what extent is Marxist-Leninist ideology really not believed in the Communist Party's elites? And if it isn't, why do they keep propagating it?
The Communist parties in Eastern Europe and in East Central Europe and in the Soviet Union for that matter, they know very well how unpopular they are at this moment. They know very well that actually, with the notable exception of the Russian Revolution in 1917, they came to power because of foreign intervention, because of foreign pressure, because of what we call a diktat. So the only solution for them is to cling to the myth of their historical role. The myth of their historical role is assigned to them by the ideology. So the ideology has to be kept in place, has to be safeguarded, regardless of whatever changes these parties might resort to. They will stick to their ideology.
How does that ideology justify them exactly? Could you explain that?
First of all, the Communist parties, according to this ideology, embody the willingness of the proletariat, of the working class. Second, they embody the idea of historical progress. So they represent the willingness, they represent the interests of the majority of the population. So they are entitled to exercise power. That's because of ideology. Now, of course, everybody knows, and primarily the proletariat in the communist countries, know they do not represent the interests of the proletariat. So there is a clash between symbols, between official ideology and real consciousness of what people believe. Now, that's the reason why ideology has to be played. People have to play ideological roles. That's also the reason for the conflict between public person and private person, which is one of the most tragic, if you want, almost schizophrenic situation in Europe. The individual is, the soul of the individual, the mind of the individual is permanently divided. The problem becomes even more difficult at the moment you have kids, for example, and they go to school, and they are always told by the family, don't tell them against the famous story, us and them, which continues to exist in Eastern Europe. It's them, I mean the school system, who says, for example, that comrade Gerek and or whoever, Jaruzelski or comrade Kadar, is the best possible leader in this world or in all possible worlds and so on. And they know that the situation is not as good as the school pretends to be. And the ideology is, in a way, I sometimes believe, I experienced a lot of things in Eastern Europe, I sometimes believe that the leaders want us to play this ideological role. Assuming that the more you play it, the more you are supposed, or the risk exists, to believe what you are supposed to say.
What are the obstacles of the communist parties themselves making their societies more liberal, sharing power?
My reading of developments or dynamics in Eastern Europe is that without division within the party elite, nothing can happen. Even the Hungarian Revolution, which was, of course, a spontaneous revolution, was favored by the division of the party elite, the disarray at the level of the party elite. And unlike some of my friends, who, especially in Solidarity Movement and in other East European independent groups, I do not underestimate the conflicts between, let's say, reform-minded and conservative-minded communists. I do not share the views of the reform-minded communists, but sometimes such a thing can, of course, the existence of a reform-minded faction, like, let's say, the Dubček faction, the Dubček-Kriegels-Murkowski faction in the Czech Communist Party, that can lead towards a kind of liberalization of the system. And these people might be really true believers. Now, of course, I would say that even the most liberal-minded communist reformer would not agree to the idea of real pluralization and fragmentation of political power. At this moment, this is the bottom line. I think they would go back into the Marxist-Leninist fold and they would repent and say that's not what we wanted.
Can I just ask you to clarify that? What do you think is the limit for even a reform communist of what he can allow?
For the time being, the limit for any kind of reform communism was to put an end to the Leninist illusion of a totally homogeneous party and to admit the existence of factions within the party. There is no communist party, not even the Italian Communist Party, which is the most liberal in the whole world. Not a single communist party has renounced the Leninist stipulation about prohibition of factions within the party. And actually, it would be impossible for them to do it, because at the moment they would accept factions within the party, then they'll renounce the dogma of the necessary break between communist parties and social democratic parties, which was the rationale for the existence, since the Communist International was established in 1919, the existence of the communist parties. So that would be the first thing. Now, I assume that somebody like Dubček might have thought of the need for factions within the party. But then, the litmus test...
What are the limits to the reforms that even the most liberal communists could allow?
Now, even somebody like Gorbachev, assuming that he would have the most utopian ideas about party tolerance, or any other communist leader in China, for example, would not go beyond a certain limit, which is ideologically imposed, which he cannot mentally overcome. And that's the idea of the party's leading role, the party's monopoly on power. They will not renounce their monopoly, their domination. This is their raison d'etre, and they are not going to give it up anyway, anywhere.
What is the role of the intellectual, the writer, the priest in Eastern Europe, and how does it differ from Western Europe?
Now, the opposition, first of all, the opposition in Eastern Europe has been for a long time primarily an intellectual opposition. Now, solidarity has changed a lot of things, but in other communist countries, still in East Germany, for example, and in Hungary, and even in Czechoslovakia, the opposition is still primarily overwhelmingly intellectual. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, that's a very important thing. The second thing is that the party claims to rely upon the intellectuals. Though it is, of course, a workers' party, though there is this kind of ouvrierist ideology, the party is very much interested. It's an ideological power, what is happening there. I dare to call it ideocracy, if you want to call it this way. So they need intellectuals, and they need party intellectuals, and they need intellectuals to support the party. So you have a division within the intelligentsia between those who have joined the chorus. Then there are, of course, those who are quite neutral, and then there are those who have decided to oppose the system in very different ways.
But do ordinary people, I mean ordinary workers in Czechoslovakia, say, do they look up to the writers, or do they feel, in some sense, the writers embody their thoughts, their conscience?
For a long time, the regimes have tried to create a kind of an antagonism between the working class and the intellectuals. In this respect, in Poland, this is a classic case, or even in Romania, intellectuals are seen as a kind of nuisance. They are those people who always criticize, those troublemakers and so on. And that has been instilled into the minds of the workers for a long time through special party meetings and all kinds of informations and confidential reports with party politburo members coming and talking to the workers and appealing to the workers. I still remember Gomulka and Gerek in 1968 going to Katowice and saying the working class is going to support the party against those intellectual adventurers and so on, the professors and the students from the Warsaw University. That's one thing. Now, things have started to change. The party cannot offer the same welfare type of advantages they have offered to the working class for a long time. That's, in a way or another, I'd call it the end of the socialist welfare state. And if it is the end of the socialist welfare state, that's, of course, the beginning of socialist class struggle. And in this respect, I can envision, not tomorrow, but in the long run, I can envision the type of alliance between certain radicalized sectors of the working class and, let's call certain segments of the intelligentsia, which would be made up also of disenchanted party intellectuals. I would not dismiss the presence of these people in such a possible coalition.
Has the trauma, the brutality of totalitarianism, the daily experience of it, even nowadays, has it in some sense been a galvanizing of creativity?
Always the experience of the limit, what the Germans call the Grenzsituation, is an extraordinary opportunity for mindful people to ponder on their life and experiences. In this respect, of course, I would compare what Stalinism has created in music, for example, and this is the most abstract of all arts, compared to what America had at that moment. I would compare Shostakovich and Prokofiev to whoever, Aaron Copland and Gershwin, and I don't know who is going to look better, the Soviet Union under Stalin or the United States under whoever, Roosevelt. However, I think that this is not, if this kind of creation, the Mandelstams, the Pasternaks, the Akhmatovas, have appeared not because of the constraints, but against the constraints. And of course, we are very much fascinated by their hard experiences and by the way they synthesized their tremendous psychological dilemmas and the psychological dilemmas of a society in deep trouble. At the same time, I don't believe that this is one of the benefits of the system. I believe it's one of the virtues of those who have resisted the system.
Why have so many leading dissidents, former fanatical ex-communists?
There is a famous saying, I think it's Ignacio Silones who said once that the final struggle is going to be the struggle between communists and ex-communists. So, first of all, after having belonged to a movement, ideological movement, I don't mean here belonging, organizational belonging, institutional belonging, to a movement which has claimed to restore human dignity, as Malraux put it in his La Condition Humaine, that's what communism provides man with, human dignity, the opposite of humility, the opposite of humiliation, then the experience of disappointment is perhaps one of the most traumatic one can have in one's life. So put it this way, on the one hand it's disenchantment, on the other hand it's also that people who have been attracted to the left, let's call it the left for the purposes of the discourse, so people who have been attracted to the left are usually also very much interested in ideals like altruism, generosity, selflessness, and so on and so forth. And these ideals, in a way or another, have to be resumed, you know, in experience or in a political experience. Some of them, of course, broke with any form of political experience. Others, like Konrad, for example, have referred to the beginning of anti-politics, of something completely different from the old political games. Now, others are still very much politically committed, like Jan Josef Lipski, trying to create the Polish Socialist Party, which is not at all anti-politics, it's very traditional politics. And still they want to continue to resume with their initial dreams. So it's a kind of prolongation of one's own radicalism.
To what extent do you think the... you're running out of time. Okay. To what extent are the opposition that emerges in Eastern Europe, is it still socialist, still left-wing? The ideals of socialism, do they still survive as the main alternative in Eastern Europe?
Being in the States, I've been asked about my own political orientation, and I have to quote here somebody. I'd prefer to quote myself, but I would quote Leszek Kolakowski with a piece he has published in Dissent magazine with the title "Why I'm a Socialist, Conservative, Liberal, Anti-Communist." So, in this respect, I think that this description, socialist, conservative, liberal, anti-communist, would provide us with the best description of the general mood of the opposition, intellectual and political opposition in East Central Europe. Left and right are primarily nowadays Western concepts. There, in those countries, people who do not think usually in terms of left or right. I don't speak here about those who have all kinds of nostalgias for the days of the monarchies or for the days of, the historical traditional parties and so on. As we hear of future-oriented people, and those who are future-oriented couldn't care less about traditional Western imposed divisions and dichotomies between left and right. Anyway, they feel these are obsolete concepts. So what they want is to create a new type of political experience, which would be, if I can say this, beyond left and right.
What do most Romanians really think of Nicolae Ceaușescu?
Mr. Ceaușescu came to power in 1965, and for some years he was quite popular as a leader in Romania because of his promise of national independence and because of his pledge to provide Romanians with more internal freedom. And he was also quite popular in the West, which for most Romanians was also a reason to be satisfied with the new image of the country in the West. Now, the situation, as many people know, deteriorated in the middle of the 1970s. And nowadays, Mr. Ceaușescu is, I would say, universally resented in Romania. This is, of course, for the West sometimes surprising, taking into account that for a long time we've been accustomed here to think of Romania as a maverick country of the Warsaw Pact, and also about Romanians being so happy with their fearless leader and so on. Social riots, social unrest and so on are widely reported in the West. For me at least, I left Romania in 1981. This is not surprising at all. I was almost sure that such a thing would occur one day or another. And this is a general sentiment among the Romanians, that the things cannot continue this way. It's very hard to accept this extraordinary monopolization of the national image, this extraordinary pressure on the Romanian people, this extraordinary, absolutely unprecedented toll required on the Romanians, or put on the Romanians by Ceaușescu's ambitions to create a great Romania. Actually, his dream is that Romania should become a major international power. And in a way, I'd say that what is happening now in Romania, I don't think I exaggerate at all, it's a kind of warfare between the party leader. I don't say the party leadership, because there is no party leadership in Romania nowadays. There is a party leader, Mr. Ceaușescu, and of course cronies and the sycophants and so on, and the population. Mr. Ceaușescu nowadays is very unhappy with the performance of his people. His, as a friend of mine, Professor Mihai Botez, a well-known Romanian dissident, once put it, Mr. Ceaușescu is very much like Führer in his last days. He thinks that the Romanian people does not live up to his expectations. And too bad then, as the Führer said, too bad for the Germans, now too bad for the Romanians. And if they have to vanish just to pay tribute to the what we call in Romanian conducator, which is a perfect translation of the German Führer, or the Russian Vojt for Stalin. So if the conducator wants to have Romanians disappear because of his extraordinary dreams of grandeur and other extravaganzas, now he will not be unhappy with that.
What's his personality like? How would you describe his personality?
There are many images of Ceaușescu. Mr. Ceaușescu was a hardened Stalin, or has been a hardened Stalinist for his whole life. He was educated within the Romanian Stalinist political culture. He joined the party during the underground period. It was not an easy decision for somebody. It took some courage to join the Romanian Communist Party during the interwar period. I still, as a student, let's say, of Romanian Communist affairs, I still wonder why he joined the Communist Party. Take into account his mindset, his mental framework and so on. I would have expected somebody like him to join the other side, let's say, maybe, you know, the extreme right or the far right in Romania. However, he joined the Communist Party. He spent some years in prison, and after the war he became, of course, the leader of the Communist Youth. Then he was a political general in the Romanian army. And he was the former leader's Gheorghe Gheorghiu Dej's protege, and he was almost appointed or anointed by Gheorghiu Dej to succeed him. Now, his personality is described by many friends who have known him during the so-called underground period, or clandestine period of the party, being almost fanatical. This man is really a single-minded person. He has one goal. He joined or he's wedded to the idea of socialism or communism in Romania, his image of communism, the image that was instilled into his mind by, let's say, the problems of Leninism, Stalin's Opus Magnus. And Mr. Ceausescu wants Romania to be really, forgive me the word, a Stalinist paradise. And he will do whatever he can for this. He has never hesitated. On the other hand, despite, of course, all the rumors and all, it's not only, they are not only rumors, this, despite the information I have about, the pleasures, luxurious pleasures and exotic, almost fanciful indulgence in luxury of the Ceausescu clan. Mr. Ceausescu, personally, I think he is very much like Stalin. Of course, he enjoys having duchess and palaces and castles, but he can easily live in a very austere environment. The family is a different story, the kids and so on. But himself, I think, he is interested in only one thing, power. Power which is used by Ceausescu to carry out and to implement his political designs. That means turning Romania into a great communist power. Perhaps in this respect, I think that he had two political models in his whole political career. One was Stalin, one projection or one way of fantasizing. And the other one, I think, everybody would be surprised, was Tito. Ceausescu was very much enamored with Tito. And like Tito, he has the same, how do I call it, Napoleonic complex. This is a too small country for his genius. And he would do whatever he can to turn Romania into a new Dacian, Thracian, empire, kingdom, or whatever.
What is the nature and extent of the personality cult in Romania? Could you give some examples of it?
Romania has created under Ceausescu something which can be compared, to the best of my knowledge, only to China during the Cultural Revolution and to North Korea under Kim Il-sung. Compared even to Enver Hoxha's cult in Albania, Mr. Ceausescu's cult is much more interesting, speaking from the point of view of political analysis or political science or the pathology of power, the way everybody is entitled to choose whatever he wants. First of all, it's not only his cult of personality, it's also the family's cult of personality. It's not only Mr. Ceausescu who is idolized, it's also Mrs. Ceausescu, and lately it's also the dolphin, the son, Nicu Ceausescu, who happens to be a former classmate of mine. And I think that the problem with Mr. Ceausescu's cult of personality, which is absolutely fantastic in terms of engineering, in terms of creating, in terms of designing all the slogans and all the rhetoric and so on. I think what is interesting nowadays in Romania, it's actually, this is a totally unbelieved cult of personality. I was told that whenever Mr. Ceausescu visits I quote reliable sources, whenever Mr. Ceausescu visits a county and he has what the French would call bande de foule, all these kind of extraordinary mass demonstrations of love, admiration, adoration, and so on, almost religious identification with the leader, he is the person, before going there, who checks all the slogans. He approves the slogans, and actually, taking into account his ambition to be considered also a poet, it's well known in Romania that he is, though it's not published this way, but it's well known that he is the author of the anonymous text, which is the text of the national anthem in Romania. And his ambition is to be a poet and many other things. So the point is that he creates the slogans, the chanted slogans, almost the rhymes, and he's very happy with this. In this respect, I think that this is also a development. The cult of personality nowadays in Romania is the main institution which guarantees the political, the symbolic reproduction of the system. There is no other institution. The school is in a very poor situation. I mean, the educational system in Romania, the university system, the high school system, and so on. Also, there is a general crisis of confidence, and so on. So the cult of personality for Mr. Ceausescu is the only way to instill values linked to his regime and to convince Romanians that his aims are worth fighting for.
What is Ceausescu's concentration of power in his own hands, his cult of personality, done to the Romanian Communist Party? Pretty short answer.
First of all, I would say that actually it has turned the Romanian Communist Party into a non-entity. Nowadays, the Romanian Communist Party plays the role of a kind of showcase for Mr. Ceausescu's grandeur and Ceausescu's, as I said, eccentricities. There is no Romanian Communist Party anymore in Romania. This situation, of course, can be compared to other communist countries where the party has increasingly declined or lost out of its influence. But in Romania, it's a different situation. Here you have the party replaced by the party leader. In other communist countries... In other communist countries, there is, of course, a lot of talk about the leading role of the party. However, we have witnessed the same erosion of the party's power. For example, Hungary, there is a lot of evidence that the party has almost lost its traditional leading role. The same thing has happened in Poland, as we all know, that the party has been almost replaced at a certain historical, critical historical juncture, problematic historical juncture by the military, or at least the political faction within the military. But there, I mean, when the party has lost its power in these countries, I mean, let's call them the developed area of socialism, it has, in a way or another, benefited the civil society or the opponents of the party. Now, in Romania, it has happened because of the man who is the party's leader, who embodies the party. Nobody would, I think, to my knowledge, nobody has talked more about the party's leading role, the Communist Party's attribute of power and so on, than Mr. Ceausescu. His first important theoretical statement when he became general secretary of the party, it was in 1966, the 45th anniversary of the Romanian Communist Party. Mr. Ceausescu wrote a long article for Scânteia, the party's newspaper, insisting on the collective leadership and so on and so forth. Everything was there in this statement, very orthodox and so on. And still he practiced the most unorthodox approach to the party's leading role. For all practical purposes, the party is nowadays in Romania an institution meant or bound to celebrate Mr. Ceausescu's power and nothing else.
What role does Elena Nicu play in this system?
First of all, Elena has been appointed by her husband with the gentle approval of the sycophantic political executive committee. She has been appointed the chairperson of the Commission for Cadres, the personnel commission of the Romanian Central Committee. So no important political appointment nowadays in Romania, even at the level of a city party committee, a mayor of a, let's say, unimportant city, has to be approved by Elena. Now, to give you an example about her ambitions and her power, nowadays in Romania, important documents are, of course, typed, and there are carbon copies, no? And Mr. Ceausescu gets the number one copy. And then Elena, being number two within the party, and this is my description of her power, Elena used to get number two copy, that means a carbon copy, and she complained. And she said that she also is entitled to have the original. So nowadays at the Central Committee of the Romanian Communist Party, they type two originals, which is quite exciting because at least because of the Romanian tradition in the theater of the absurd, one day the Central Committee of the Romanian Communist Party might have two different originals. And a contradiction between the two different originals can create a crisis in the top leadership. But this is a joke. I still assume that they have the same originals. Elena is extremely powerful, extremely shrewd. She knows very well the intricacies of power. She is very much prone to intrigues and so on. And she has been the eminence grise and actually the driving force in promoting Nicu to an increasingly powerful position. Nicu has been, for a long time, well known for his playboy proclivities and so on. At the same time, he's very much interested in power, and I would not underestimate his thirst for power.
To what extent is the whole system of power, sort of clan system, a family system there?
Nowadays, Romania is ruled by a political clan. and I would dare to call whatever is happening now in Romania the tribalization of socialism. It's almost a dynastic scenario with the holy trio working there, aspiring to create or to eternize Ceausescu's power. Ceausescu is too much familiar with the experience of contemporary socialism, with whatever has happened in other countries, to know that all his monuments, statues, portraits, and so on can disappear from one day to the other after his biological or political passing away. The problem, that, therefore, for him, this man is really interested in eternity. He is committed to eternity. So the problem for him is to ensure eternity, to get eternity. And the only solution would be to promote somebody who could not biologically by links of consanguinity would not betray him. Not a Khrushchev to betray Stalin, not a whatever Dubček to betray Novotny or somebody else, Gerek, to betray Gomulka. No, somebody who owes everything to him and he and is related. And this person would be, of course, his son.
Is Romania a Marxist state?
Romania is, of course, described by official propaganda, Romanian and Soviet too, I mean not only Romanian, as a Marxist-Leninist state. It belongs to the Warsaw Pact, it belongs to the Comic-Con, it belongs to all the official organizations. According to the party bylaws, Marxism-Leninism is the official ideology and so on and so forth. But beyond this veneer of the appearances, Romania has turned into something else. It's very difficult for me to describe, I think, to conceptualize the reality of power, the nature of power in contemporary Romania. The best term perhaps would be socialist feudalism or social feudalism. There's a combination of feudal rigidity with this almost feudal despotism, with the rules which remind one of the rules of before the constitutional monarchy. Romania is not a constitutional monarchy. Romania is absolute monarchy. And actually the practices, I mean agriculture and so on, what they have managed to do in Romania, Ceausescu and his folks, was to carry to an extreme the logic of Stalinism. I would call Romania the perfect example of what Stalinism would have meant had Stalin not died in 1953.
What is the role of Securitate in Romania?
According to the general belief in Romania, Romania is a champion within the system in terms of security police infiltration of all groups and all communities and all collectivities and so on. Actually, no political, independent, political, social, whatever organizations or association can exist nowadays in Romania. The security police controls everything, from the writers' union to the graphic artists' union or the composers' union. I don't mean by that the writers are members of the security police. Of course, there are some members, but there is a perfect surveillance of everything. Of course, they are very well paid. They are the only people in Romania nowadays who might say that they are happy from the point of view of their salaries, of their special food stores, of all the things that are the privileges that they are provided with by the party. However, I would mention something which seems to me quite symptomatic and encouraging in a way, is the fact that recently, it seems that some people at the top, some top people in the hierarchy of the security police in Romania have realized how dangerous the current course is. Otherwise, I could not or I cannot explain leaks from Romanian official government sources and also kind of tolerance on the part of the security police. At the moment, an important party veteran, Silvio Brucan, came with his statement after the Brasov riots. This statement was given or provided by Brucan in Bucharest. Brucan lives very close to Ceausescu in the neighborhood, I mean the presidential neighborhood in Bucharest. And still he was able to get in touch with a British journalist to provide him with a statement, to call that guy, again to call other media people and so on, without a kind of, I wouldn't say complicity, I would say a kind of benign neglect on the part of the security police. Things like that would not happen in a communist
country. Why would a faction of the Securitate want to replace Ceausescu?
I think it's a matter of being fed up in a way or another with all this cult. They are the best informed people in Romania. Nobody is better informed than the security police people. They know exactly what is now smoldering in Romania, what are the problems that actually things are boiling there, and a kind of spontaneous explosion, absolutely unchanneled, uncontrolled, with no leading group organization you can talk to, like, I don't know, CORE in Poland or even the democratic opposition nowadays in Hungary. So such a thing might result in a disastrous experience or adventure for the security police. They would be the first victims. They know how hated they are. So at this moment, the end of the Ceausescu dictatorship would not mean, and helping the end of the Ceausescu dictatorship by the security police would not mean that they don't like this dictatorship. They know now that nowadays Ceausescu represents a risk for them. And in order to defend their position, they would have to get rid of Ceausescu.
Thank you.